Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here with, as usual, or hopefully as usual, Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking to a sociologist. We don't do that very often, but this particular sociologist has got some insights into another form of, I guess, global warming, and that's the concept of urban heat islands. It's a fascinating thing, and so you're going to be in for a treat for the next 28 minutes. Russ, who's our guest?
We're happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Sharon Harlan. And she's from Arizona State University and the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, School of Human Evolution and Social Change. Welcome to Science Studio, Sharon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, that's a very long name for a department. Why do they have such a long name instead of sociology?
Well, it's not a sociology department, for one thing. It used to be an anthropology department. And in the spirit of interdisciplinarity about 6 years ago, the department was expanded to include some other social science, sociology, geography. We have certain themes like urban society and environment and society that we emphasize across disciplinarity.
That's good. I mean, the interdisciplinary nature, I suppose, demands this long title.
Yes, and the name, I guess, was the subject of intense negotiation. I was on sabbatical then, so I had no part in that naming. But it's, I think, meant to evoke the deep time perspective that archaeology brings, and then change is the more historical and contemporary.
Before we get into this lovely concept of an urban heat island, why don't we talk a little bit about Sharon? I mean, how did you become into the sciences? How did you get into this whole game?
Well, first I became a sociologist. In my early career, I was doing something quite different. Growing up, my background was the civil rights movement in the United States and the women's movement, and I was really fascinated with inequalities in society. And for a long time, I worked in the area, research area of women and labor market studies, looking at issues like job segregation and pay equity. When I came to Arizona State from the East, I was fascinated by the different environment and the rapidly growing population and the resources like water and heat that were so different from where I had come from, and got involved with some people at the Center for Environmental Studies, began doing some social survey work in terms of people's attitudes toward the environment and their neighborhoods and their quality of life, and things just blossomed from there because I met people in different scientific fields, and then we began to focus on heat as one of Phoenix's most.
So let me just, before we get onto that, the one you go back to your sort of adolescence and pre-adolescence as a young girl, were you sort of activated by who? I mean, the women's movement, Betty Friedan, as a young girl, were you sort of activated by that movement at that time, or was it just a natural evolution for you based upon your family?
I was activated by really the civil rights movement, I think, was the first thing that came along. And so in college, I was very into looking at African-American studies, a lot of African-American friends. And that's really where my interest in inequality started. And it wasn't really until graduate school that I started thinking about women, and particularly low-income women's employment and their education and training, and how they were disadvantaged in the labor market trying to make a living. So I became, it kind of progressed from one thing to another.
Okay. So, urban heat island.
Yes.
What is an urban heat island? I mean, I think we all got a vague idea. There's a lot of concrete in cities, and that makes them hotter than they should be. But
yes. So the urban heat island, from the sociologist's perspective, well, it is what we do, what humans do to natural landscapes by building cities. They change the land cover. They remove vegetation. They replace it with concrete and impervious surfaces that absorb and hold heat. And in Phoenix, at least, this works. The best expression of it is at the nighttime, when heat is released so slowly that the city doesn't cool down. And then the next day, it heats up more quickly, and so forth. And so it is kind of the phenomenon of the concrete jungle. I know this notion of it's been around for 100 years. People have known about this, but there was a geographer in the 1970s, Timothy Oak, who wrote about and quantified the expression of it as, you know, the temperature differential between the city and the outlying areas. So that's what it is physically. I think one of the parts that is of sociological interest is that you just don't characterize a whole city by one temperature. Cities are very heterogeneous in terms of their land cover, in terms of the population characteristics of people who live in different parts of the city. And so what I'm interested in as a sociologist is its effect on different neighborhoods and how that is associated with the types of people who live in those neighborhoods. So it's really my interest in inequality transferred to another
exactly.
area.
So is there indeed for every city, can you go and look up a table that gives you this delta T, the difference in temperature between downtown and just say 10, 15 or whatever you need miles outside?
Well, I don't know if there's one table that does that, but you could probably construct a table by looking at the literature and finding studies that have been done of a lot of different cities that would quantify that relationship.
You know, because when they talk about what are the best cities to live in, then you presumably want one with the smallest delta T. It's just another thing to put on your advertisement to attract people to your city.
Perhaps.
Which will then, of course, increase delta T dramatically. But
well,
never mind.
I know, for example, Tokyo. Because I've worked with people in Tokyo, that they have an enormous problem of this type in Tokyo. The city is just completely much hotter than probably anywhere in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a worldwide
right.
problem. And so when you say global climate change, this is not the kind of global climate change that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is talking about. It's a global problem, but it's cities all over the world. Each generating these. So there's a lot of studies on China, on Korea, Japan, you're mentioning, Australia. Every continent, I think, except Antarctica and Africa, because Africa doesn't have the huge cities yet.
But the implication is, of course, that what you're talking about is it's too hot. But, of course, if you're in Winnipeg, this whole concept of a heat island in the middle of, Manitoba would be quite useful.
Well, yeah, and actually, when we talk about temperature in cities, we have to remember that there can be benefits to warming, too, in colder climates, right? Because
right.
then fewer people are harmed by cold. There's another issue, though, that temperate cities in Canada and the northeastern United States face, and that's these heat wave events where they're not prepared for the sudden spike in temperature. And actually, the city of Toronto is very involved in trying to figure out ways to protect people from these spikes in temperature that occur more and more often.
So let's talk then about Phoenix. What are the variations that have happened over the years? There's always been, I'm sure, a variation of temperature. Let's go daytime, nighttime, and then outlying, and then central. What are the trends? What are the numbers?
Okay, so over the last century, in the time that Phoenix evolved from an agricultural community to the huge 4 million-person metropolitan area,
4 million now.
Yes, that it is now, the average daily summer temperature has increased from like 98 to 105 degrees over the last century. So there's a rise in that way. The difference, one of my colleagues, Anthony Brazel, who's a climatologist, urban climatologist at Arizona State, has done studies that show that over the last 50 years, the gap in temperature between the central city of Phoenix and outlying areas has increased to about 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's a huge and growing gap.
That's at daytime high
that
and
is
nighttime
a, that
high.
Is a right. daily minimum. That is
oh,
a daily
minimum.
Mm-hmm. So that would be the low.
Right.
So combination of rising temperatures and increasing gap. And very little of that is due to global warming. That is the heat
local,
island.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, you remind me, I remember back when I was a student living in Brooklyn. And we were living in sort of a marginal neighborhood. We got an air conditioner out window. Mm-hmm. And I remember my wife was very upset when she realized that we were actually making it hotter for the people outside that couldn't afford the air conditioner.
That's right. And I work with another scientist. Her name is Suzanne Grossman-Clark, who does mesoscale weather modeling and looks at the heat sources that contribute to the heat island. And so it is not only the built environment, but vehicle traffic exhaust air conditioners.
What about this equality thing where some have air conditioners and others can't afford it?
Well, yes, I think probably when people think about Phoenix,
Everybody's got it,
but actually they don't. And so we've done some work looking at the tax assessor's records to see what's recorded in terms of air conditioning, central air in homes. And 13% of single-family dwellings do not have it. And we did a survey in 3 low-income neighborhoods a couple years ago and found that, you know, those figures are higher in low-income neighborhoods. People do not all have central air.
But let me interject, because Phoenix is quite a young city.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like it's been there for 100 years or more.
Well,
so
100.
Most of it, right, yeah, but most of it is,
yes,
is relatively new.
Yes.
When people were building houses, so they were building even 30 years ago, for example, 40 years ago, they built houses without air conditioning?
Yeah, because the, Phoenix has a long history of poverty, like Mexican Americans and moving into areas that were very poor. So the housing quality could be very poor.
Minimal.
Yeah, minimal. And so, yeah, there are homes that are built like shacks, really, that are.
Well, when you think about it historically, I mean, air conditioning is a pretty modern invention.
Ironically, that's the whole reason Phoenix grows like it does, because of the refrigeration, yeah, you know, after the war, then it was,
I mean,
able
it started
to
out when they first made block ice, mm-hmm, right? I mean, block ice was just a tremendous asset to the west, southwest. And the original air conditioning, you just get block ice and blow the air in. But swamp cooling, I mean,
yes,
maybe that's a difference, because El Paso is not exactly a wealthy city.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the numbers for the number of, mm-hmm, dwellings that don't have air conditioning, and I may be very surprised. But most houses that have ever been built here, since I've seen houses being built, have swamp cooling put in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not quite so efficient then, presumably, in the climate of Phoenix area, where you get these much higher temperatures and, at least in the summer, monsoon time, very sticky.
That's right. And I don't know the figures on swamp coolers, but that is an alternative form of cooling in Phoenix that is prevalent in low-income areas. And, yes, there have been studies done that show that the efficiency of those goes way down during the monsoon when the humidity is high. That is near the hottest period of the year.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Sharon Harlan from Arizona State University, and we will be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. When a person goes from a weak heart to heart failure, what happens in that transition? Finding an answer may help slow down the process or perhaps reverse it.
Recently, scientists identified a protein called RBFOX2 that appears to be important in heart muscle health. The protein helps regulate a process important in the maintenance of muscles.
Researchers noticed very low levels of RBFOX2 in the heart of mice suffering from a condition similar to heart failure. When they genetically engineered mice to eliminate this protein, the mice developed symptoms of heart failure.
Both cases suggest there's a connection between the levels of this protein and heart muscle decline. When a heart first weakens, it compensates by expanding to work harder, and blood pressure rises to increase blood flow to the heart.
As the heart continues to weaken, people enter the decompensatory phase and face fatigue and shortness of breath. This is where RBFOX2 levels really decline, so that instead of repairing, which the heart can do, it weakens further.
Researchers found that lower levels of the protein lead to changes in the way genes are used that mimic heart failure. Just why this happens, we don't know yet.
We also don't know if it's possible to raise RBFOX2 levels, and if so, whether that would slow heart decline. About half of people diagnosed with heart failure die within 5 years. Even though there are medicines to help with symptoms, they don't actually make the heart stronger.
In the end, only a heart transplant can offer a cure, but that's not an option for most people suffering heart disease, since they're usually older. Finding a way to treat this disease would offer hope to millions.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Sharon Harlan from Arizona State University. And we're talking about what are called urban heat islands. And that is the capacity to have very extreme high temperatures in big cities, where just 10 miles away in the hinterland or whatever it would be called, much cooler. So you've identified this phenomenon, or it's been identified.
My colleagues have identified this, yes.
In Phoenix. What impact then does that happen? Where do the disparities in your eyes lie because of that phenomenon, and what should we do to correct it?
Well, the overall picture of the heat island is that cities do need to begin paying much more attention to the built environment, the vegetation, the types of materials that they build with, cutting down on traffic because that's a source of anthropogenic heat as well. But our real interest is in the residential neighborhoods, which have vastly different temperatures, we discover, which has to do a lot with differences in landscaping. It has to do with other things like altitude. Our interest really is in landscapes because in Phoenix, water scarcity is a problem. And so whether people can maintain vegetation depends on whether they can afford to water it. And also, the urban expansion of Phoenix has tended to be into areas that were previously farmland and still have agriculture going on there. So they have natural vegetation, and that's where higher-income people can live. So through a series of choices that upper-income people have, either to move near vegetation or to have lush vegetation in their yards and neighborhoods, they actually produce cooler temperatures. So money buys actually cooler temperatures, which lower-income areas don't have.
And money buys higher temperatures if you need it in that appropriate. Money buys more or less the style of life that you really want.
Yes. And so here's a real obvious issue where money can buy actual environmental amenities included in your style of life. And so not only are the temperatures hotter in these low-income neighborhoods, but of course people have fewer coping mechanisms. We talked about air conditioning, so fewer places with air conditioning. Their parks are often desert parks without vegetation. They just have fewer options for the ways that they can handle this. So
let's just talk about it before you go on. To the city of Phoenix not have ordinances that prescribe that, you know, you cannot have so much grass, or do they make it prohibitively expensive when you go past a certain threshold of water use by having a sliding scale so that water is not so cheap? I mean, is the city addressing that by some legal aspects right now or ordinances?
Well, when we talk about Phoenix, we're talking about the metro area, and so there's more than 20 independent municipalities that we're talking about, all with different types of ordinances. Also have the situation where many developments and subdivisions are built with homeowners associations, which also can have policies about what you can plant in your yards and so on and so forth. So that whole area of ordinance is very complex. One of the results of the water scarcity issue over the last years is that a lot of the municipalities and homeowners associations have been promoting xeriscaping, which is basically crushed granite with plants, okay? And so you have a drip irrigation system. So that actually can save water, although there's some debate about that, but it then increases anthropogenic heat because you're not using grass and trees to cool the surfaces. So the ordinance question is complicated, and this water-saving policy has perhaps even contributed to the heat island effect.
Although in the xeriscaping, which is an issue here in El Paso, one argument is that that's the natural way things should be. So it is warmer, it's a desert.
Mm-hmm.
But it uses less water, and you should not have, a golf putting green on your front lawn.
Yes, we have all these issues in Phoenix as well. But, you know, there have been studies of xeriscaped versus mesic, that is grass landscapes in Phoenix. And because of the way people water them, there's some question about whether they're really saving water because they overwater the xeric landscape. And the golf course owners will tell you that they're using recycled water.
No, but it's pretty obvious that if you have xeriscaping and your desert plants in your xeriscape, you don't need to water them every second day like you do with grass.
Well, you're saying xeriscaping, and I've heard that distinguished from xeriscaping with an I, in which the plants may not all be native
plants. Yeah, sure,
plants.
But I mean, if you just take the scientific point that use the plants that are here and they're used to a little bit of water versus plants that are not here that need a lot of water,
maybe there aren't
clear.
Any plants there except those bloody great big saguaro cacti. So these are issues that
Are all issues of humans understanding the environment. We have migrants from all parts of the country who don't necessarily understand.
Well, what
these.
About that then? Because I noticed that in other parts of the world, for example, where in the wintertime the poor people are actually taking trees, burning them for heat and cooking and so on. And so when you really talk about this, there's also a population issue. You know, are there too many people in Phoenix or anywhere?
Well, that's also a big topic of conversation, whether Phoenix has outstripped its ability to support the population that's there with the water supply that is going to be available in the future. The city managers assure us that they have planned carefully and there's enough water, but there is an admitted need for water conservation. And yes, the population continues to grow.
So, well, this is all very interesting. So what are the current thrusts of your research then? Are you trying to ameliorate this, get that delta T down, or are you just trying to make people cope with it better? How do you go with this?
Well, what we're trying to do is actually to relate this to some measurable health outcomes. A lot of studies about environmental issues talk about the impact on people's health, but it's very hard to get actual health measures to verify that and to actually measure disparities between higher and low-income populations. So we are really focused on the issue of neighborhood environmental effects on people's health related to heat stress and living in hot environments. So we are working with epidemiologists, and we are extracting death certificates and hospital and emergency department visit records and working on how you determine whether people are admitted because of heat-related illnesses and actually plotting those against temperature, local temperature in neighborhoods to see what the disparities actually are.
And
we're doing that, and we have looked at deaths, and we find that, as in many places, most of the people who actually die from heat-related illnesses, and especially in periods of high temperatures, are elderly people. They are physiologically more susceptible to heat. However, what we find when we map the location of the deaths is that there are clusters of deaths, and these tend to fall in low-income areas, and that there are differences in the age profile of minority versus the Anglo population in terms of who's dying. So many more people in the ethnic minority groups are younger people who are dying. So these are some preliminary
issues. I mean, there you would also have to ask questions about availability of health services, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct, and how much access they have to health care. Mm-hmm. That's an important issue. Deaths are the tip of the iceberg in terms of the effect of heat on people's health, because most people would not particularly die from it, but they might go to the emergency room. They might be hospitalized from it. And they were also doing social surveys that look at the self-reported symptoms that people have that never rise to the level of actually seeking care.
Right. I mean, I'm just reminded of this Monty Python song, you know, look on the bright side of life. And then they come up with, well, for God's sake, look on the bright side of death. I mean, look, some of those pointers that you made, in a sense, to someone outside, they seem quite obvious, right? The biggest impact will be on the old. The biggest
yes.
impact will be on those under economically stressed, etc.,
yes.
which includes large numbers of underrepresented minorities, etc.
Yes.
Okay, now you're getting quantitative data for that.
Yes.
So the implication would be, okay, what do you do with that data? I mean, how do you impact?
All right. Well, this is really... The point, of course, is to be able to enhance the adaptive capacity of these communities. And there are a couple ways of doing this. You can do top-down strategies. You can try to convince city government, service agencies about things that they need to do to pay particular attention to these communities, which at present they do not. What our research team puts more faith in is actually bottom-up grassroots partnerships with some of these low-income communities that finds out how they position themselves in terms of adaptation to heat and air pollution and all the other environmental stressors that they face. So what we're trying to do is partner with them, give them, these community leaders and the residents, information about what the issues are, and try to help them figure out and actually take a lead from them in what they are doing. And some of the things they're trying to do is get more vegetation for their parks so that they do have cool areas in their neighborhoods. They are starting community gardens. A lot of gardeners realize the cooling effect of plants on the community. So we're trying to take a lead from those communities in terms of how they see themselves best able to adapt, build on their strengths, reclaiming some of their former vegetative mm-hmm. landscapes, and
so
work with them.
So it's a lot of community outreach, in a sense,
yes.
taking your data and then going back into the community.
Yes.
Now, I know in your area they have this wonderful expression called a vulnerability factor.
Yes.
This is associated then, the greater your factor, the more at risk you are because of this particular aspect.
Yes. So a working definition of vulnerability, you would take there is a hazard, some kind of environmental hazard. In this case, it would be heat, extreme temperatures. There's a sensitivity of the population. People have different sensitivities. Age would be one factor. Socioeconomics is another. And then you think about coping mechanisms. Can people have the resources to recover from their exposure to this hazard?
So the long-term plan then is to impact the vulnerability factor
That's
to
right.
your citizens and get that number down low.
Right, to decrease the vulnerability in
so
the most vulnerable places.
Come back in 25 years to Science Studio and we'll be able to see what the impact
okay.
has been, right? Thank you so much for being here.
All right, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, thanks for being here, Sharon Harlan from Arizona State University.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Indeed. It's been a fascinating program. The more we do these programs, the more we learn. And there's so many ways that people are using their scientific training in one form or another to reduce our vulnerability factor. Hey, Sharon, again, thank you so much for being here. Thanks to the audience. You're the ones that make this program possible. Bye-bye.